Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the unprecedented carnage of the Civil War change the way Americans thought about and coped with the realities of death? An estimated 750,000 people lost their lives as a result of the war between the Union and the Confederacy, which amounted to 2.5% of the total population at the time. And the scale of those losses had a lasting impact, not only on those left to mourn them on a personal level, but also on the role of the federal government in accounting for lost lives, notifying loved ones, and honoring soldiers who had made the ultimate sacrifice. Filmmaker Rick Burns explores all this in his new documentary, Death and the Civil War. It premieres tomorrow night on PBS stations, including KERA Channel 13, as part of the American Experience series. Rick, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I think many people are aware that today is the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Antietam, which to this day remains the single largest casualty count for a single day for the United States. The sheer magnitude of that death toll today is no less stunning than it must have been back then.
It's so stunning. You know, Chris, I was at Antietam yesterday, and you know, here's this extraordinarily beautiful Maryland countryside where 150 years ago, to this day, to this hour, this battle that had began a little before dawn, 6 o'clock, on what one lieutenant colonel of a Union regiment called a misty, moisty morning, in a letter he wrote home to his mother shortly before being killed. You know, more Americans would die on any single day than in any other time in history before or since. And not only that, what's so moving to me about it is that that day was the fulcrum, the kind of the pivot point of the entire war. And in ways that are, boy, you could go on forever about it, the country we live in today really began as those bodies piled up in the cornfield at the north part of the battlefield along a beautiful bucolic country road called the Sunken Road, now called the Bloody Lane, or further south at a place called Burnside's Bridge, named for the Union General Ambrose Burnside, who took such heavy casualties trying to get over it. It's one of those moments where history kind of funnels into one very narrow channel, and things before that day were not the same as they were after that day.
Part of what made the Civil War so bad in terms of casualties was that weapons technology had leapt forward while medical science was making incremental progress.
That's
Is that right?
A perfect way to put it. 20 years before, you'd never have seen these casualties. 20 years after, you wouldn't have either. I mean, the rifled musket alone, which is basically a mini ball now that it's being spun out of the rifle, the spiral grooves in the barrel of a musket, now has a kind of a perfect spin like a quarterback throwing a Hail Mary pass that it didn't have 10 or 20 years before. That meant the old tactics, mass your men, mass your fire, were obsolete because that was a lethal degree of accuracy. But we still didn't have a germ theory of disease. We didn't understand how sepsis worked. Doctors worked, you know, overtime at these battles to kind of amputate limbs without any kind of washing their hands. They would do 100 in a day. And so the men who fought in this war found themselves gathered into a conflagration which was so unprecedented, so beyond the scope and scale of anybody to imagine. I mean, think about it. First Manassas in the summer of 1861, the first big battle, though it itself was dwarfed by all the battles that came after. You know, in the Mexican War, 1846 to 1848, we lost a total battlefield death of 2,200 men. We lost half that number in 12 hours at First Manassas, First Battle of Bull Run. So you understand that it's not as if the government was, you know, flawed or had done something wrong or should be castigated. No one could begin to conceive that you could have casualties on this scale.
And you talk about no germ theory of disease. In fact, actual disease, not related to getting a limb infected or something, was a huge scourge for large numbers of soldiers.
I mean, imagine this. Two out of three of the deaths in the Civil War were death by disease, dysentery, typhoid, diarrhea, scarlet fever. It was a tremendous problem. First of all, you had armies that were vaster than any armies that had been mobilized in Europe or America before. 2-3 million men under arms by the end of the Civil War, 2 million in the North, 880,000 in the South. These are not professional soldiers. These are vast armies of citizen soldiers being brought in out of mainly in the South, rural environments, where their immune systems aren't used to being crowded together. So you create these great incubators of disease. And there were so many casualties in those camps and in the prison camps and in the hospitals just because of disease. Again, 2 out of 3 of the deaths came from disease alone. And not just soldier deaths. There were all sorts of collateral deaths that came to civilians. Abraham Lincoln, Mary Todd Lincoln's son Willie, died in the war. Of what? Typhoid. He had not been in a camp. He hadn't been fighting in the war. He was, you know, under 10 years old. But he was living in the White House, which was along the Potomac. And the Potomac was home to, was polluted by the largest standing army in the world at that time. And they had no sense that your latrines needed to be different from where, you know, your camp was. So it was a very complicated set of factors. But the most important thing to understand is that it was lethal in a degree no one had ever experienced, certainly not in America or in Europe.
So let's step back here for a minute and talk about what 19th century Americans thought of as the right way to die. Certainly this was a time when people had seen family members die. It was not something unusual, but it happened in a way that was sort of as peaceful as possible.
It's such an incredibly important point you're sort of focusing on. You know, mid-19th century America was a profoundly devout country. I mean, we're still a devout country, but we can't even imagine how devout we were. 98% Christian. You know, more people, as Drew Faust, the historian whose book This Republic of Suffering, our film is based on, points out in the film and in her book, more people went to church every Sunday than voted in the election of 1860. Mm. And it was a particularly devout Christian nation who understood that, yes, they had many more ways to die in childbirth, in childhood, than we do today. But the fact is that they could count on dying at home. And it was crucial to die at home. It was crucial to meet this kind of mysterious end-of-life moment, knowing that your family was around you, or knowing that your family member who was passing away was right there. And you could see by the look on his or her face that they were at peace with themselves, that they were prepared to meet their maker, that the things undone in this world were being finished as they prepared for this mysterious passage. So now suddenly take a population of 30, 31 million people and throw 3 million of them onto the battlefields of the Civil War, far from home, sometimes 1,000 miles from home. Most of these kids, most of these young men hadn't been 5 miles from home before. Are they able to die a good death with last words and in the fond embrace of family? Not at all. They're among strangers. They're being obliterated by cannon fire and shell and ordnance or the fire from rifled muskets or from disease in an enemy hospital or prison camp far from home. So every aspect, everything that 19th century America counted on to provide the context for a good death, as they called it, was challenged by the Civil War. And one of the most moving things that Drew Faust points out in her book and that I hope translates into our film is a powerful way in which Americans tried to improvise the circumstances of a good death under which the actual pressures were as hostile to a good death as possible, where you would be, and you have to remember, the federal government and the Confederate government, neither of them had any systems in place to deal with death on this scale. There was no ambulance corps to deal with it. There was no system for notifying next of kin. There was no system for burying people in a way that assured that their families would ever find out what was happening to them. So people, as they confronted these increasingly horrific battles, understood that they were going into a kind of an oblivion that challenged their most deeply held and understood religious beliefs, but also kind of meant that their families would never even find out what happened to them. And so soldiers would appeal to each other to write letters home on their behalf and tell their families that they had been prepared for death, you know, sort of assuring each other, in a sense, acting in place of what we now assume is the job of the government. They would notify each other's next of kin. They would be the family members in absentia describing last words, what their temperament was as they prepared to meet their maker. So what you see in this transformative four-year period is Americans improvising new solutions to the immemorial problem of death. Really, I think, ultimately as never before, whether it's a question of new religious ideas, new government systems, new ideas of what the government owes citizens, whom it is asked to die in the name of the state. And the most, in that equation, one of the most important things to remember is that these are citizen soldiers, not professional soldiers, fighting in vast citizen armies, a war which in the course of that war will come to be understood as a war about the meaning and definition of citizenship in America. And that transformation at the largest level is sort of what comes into focus when you look at death through the prism, look at the Civil War through the prism of death, that the Civil War asks so much of its citizens that the nature of government, the nature of what the state owes its citizens was dramatically transformed in that four-year period.
Rick, tell us about the really remarkable document that opens the film from J.R. Montgomery.
You know, it's one of the most moving documents. You know, I've been working with my brother Ken for 20 or 30 years making documentary films. If you go to the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, you could ask for and see yourself this letter from a private in the Confederate Signal Corps in a Virginia regiment. He's, in fact, from Mississippi. Killed in the spring of 1864, the bloodiest year of the war by far. And he's writing a letter home on a night in May to his father back in Camden, James Robert Montgomery, in his early 20s. And essentially he's giving his father his own death notice, apprising his father and his family of the horrific shoulder wound he had sustained that day, dripping blood on the paper as he writes. You can see those blood stains on the letter to this day. And saying, "Dear Father, this is my last letter to you. I've been wounded horribly. I certainly know death will come soon." And in a statement and a phrase which is so striking to 21st century ears, he says, "Father, I know you would be delighted to receive a letter from your dying son." And we, from our own perspective, go, "Oh, my goodness, what does that mean, delighted?" But, of course, James means delighted because the likely alternative was you would hear nothing. Well, more than half of the soldiers who died in the Civil War died deaths that were unknown. Their families inferred it but never received notification. Their bodies were never found. There was never any closure to the story of their lives. And so in the case of James Montgomery's family, they had that extraordinary blessing of knowing in their son's own words what had happened to him, where it had happened, the relative peace he had made with himself and with them. That was unusual because for most families dealing with this trauma, for most soldiers who died on the battlefield, facing death under these circumstances, the reality was an abrupt discontinuity in the most important connection any of us have, the bond with family and friends and loved ones.
My guest is documentary filmmaker Rick Burns. His new production, Death and the Civil War, premieres tomorrow night on PBS's American Experience. If you'd like to join the conversation or ask a question, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Rick Burns. His new production, Death and the Civil War, premieres tomorrow night on PBS's American Experience. You can see it here in North Texas on KERA Television Channel 13. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Rick, I want to go a little further into this idea of no official notification being expected from the military to families who had lost a loved one. It's almost inconceivable now, I think.
It is inconceivable, isn't it? I mean, the war before the Civil War, the Mexican-American War, 1846 to 1848, about 2,200 battlefield deaths. Each one of those was a crucial tragedy to the person who underwent it, to their families back home. But they're relatively small numbers. That's over a two-year period. What that means is that essentially the systems in place that have to do with kinship, family, friendship are going to be burying the dead. The word of death is going to be brought back home tragically and sorrowfully by friends, by fellow brother officers. That's how the news gets back home. So now imagine you're in a war in which 12 hours, you get about half that number as in 2 years. How does that possibly happen? So the government really didn't understand. No government understood that you could be engaged in carnage on a scale that all the available ad hoc systems, the systems of civil society, how families work, how churches work, how localities work, those would be overwhelmed entirely by casualty lists that, A, were casualties happening so far from home, nobody at home could know how to grasp them at numbers which the government itself couldn't possibly have the means on hand to take care of it. And so what you had was a sense that no one was in charge, because in a funny way, you were dealing with a reality about which no one had ever imagined you would have to be able to be in charge of this scope of carnage. So when Frederick Law Olmsted, who was the designer of Central Park in New York, and who quickly became head of the U.S. Sanitary Commission, a private voluntary agency, one of a number in the North that was established when it became clear that the government was being overwhelmed by the medical needs and by the sheer death toll of the war. When he came south to take command of the U.S. Sanitary Commission, he watched sort of dumbstruck in the early spring of 1862. Now the casualties are getting even larger. And one of the signal facts of the Civil War is that every year they mounted. So each year was a horrific exponential increase on the year that had gone before. And as Frederick Law Olmsted stood on the peninsula of Virginia looking at kind of trainloads of wounded and dead men in boxcars, or boatloads of wounded and dead men being sort of offloaded on wharves, he wrote sorrowfully to his wife, you know, in this republic of suffering, individuals don't really count for much anymore. And I think that sense in which a reality of mass warfare, warfare fought in armies that were now mass armies, supplied by the means and technology of an industrial revolution, railroads and communications through telegraph, no one knew how to, in fact, continue a sacrament and a cultural and family ritual which is by definition local. It is we, the family, who take our own dead from where they died into the grave where their remains lie. How do you do that at a national scale with masses of dead men? And that, the Civil War, four-year period, remarkably rapid and contained period, was the year in which, in a funny way, America woke up to what it was becoming, a mass society. And one of the cruelest and most difficult ways in which it grasped that was, how do we undertake this most crucial of human rituals? All of us die. As Mark Shantz says in our film, our mortality is assured. How do we deal with this most critical of life's passages, the passage from life to death, when it's happening now not on a family scale, not on a village or town scale, but on a national scale in which we have no easy way to reach out with our hearts and our minds and grasp what that means?
So there emerges this really sort of grisly ritual for families waiting at home for word of their loved ones. There would be newspapers that tried to print out lists of the known dead.
Chris, imagine what that was like.
Oh.
We sort of imagine, we assume that, of course, when the worst comes in warfare, that the federal government will say, "Dear sir, madam, we regret to inform you." But there's no mechanism like that in place at all. Instead, what there is are sort of casualty lists which have been compiled by the War Department for purely military reasons only. Casualty lists which are being gleaned by newspapers, you know, the New York Times or the Tribune or Harper's Weekly or the Richmond Examiner, and then published. So you know your son, your husband, your brother is in action at Antietam, and the battle's now over. You go to your local newspaper, and you scan the list. Sometimes those lists are actually put up in the town square, hoping against hope not to see your son's name, your brother's name, your father's name, your husband's name, because the government is in no position to be able to provide you with that information. That information is highly inexact. Families often discover that their loved one, though reported dead, was alive, though reported wounded, was in fact dead. They would spend weeks, months, indeed years in a kind of agony of uncertainty as they waited for the news of what happened to their loved one. And one of Drew Faust's, to me, most moving sort of illuminating insights in her book, This Republic of Suffering, is the way in which, not just for months or years, for decades after the Civil War, you had a grief-stricken America. Imagine 30 million people who had lost 750,000 of their own. That's 2.5% of the population. That would be the equivalent today in our population of 7 million dead. A population of people grief-stricken, wondering for decades, will he come home? I know it's magical thinking to think that he will come home, but I never had his body. I never had notification. I didn't know what happened. Maybe he will walk in the door having been head injured or temporarily insane. It could happen. And every one of us knows that until we had the brutal certainty of the death of our loved one, none of us will let go of that, because that's the primal connection. We don't ever want that connection to be broken. And when it is broken, the only thing that provides us any kind of solace is some piece of information, a lock of hair, a letter from a friend, the report from the surgeon who was there before he died after the limb was amputated, anything that gives us something concrete to hold on to. And the Civil War was such an assault on a society which, like all societies, needs that concrete information about what happened to its dead loved ones. And out of that chasm, out of the abyss of grief and uncertainty and severed connection, which was the Civil War, so many of the things that we as Americans hold as sacred and second nature came out. The absolutely unbreakable obligation of the government to bring the body home, to notify next of kin, to honor these men and now men and women who die for the state and say, we will never forget what they did. These things which are the most, this is the air we breathe and the water we drink in 21st century America, and it has been for centuries. That really began at the Civil War when we were plunged horrifically into an entirely new set of circumstances. And I have to say that with my brother Ken, you know, I had the enormous privilege of working on a series about the Civil War more than two decades ago. This particular way of understanding it, through what Drew Faust knows in her bones, was the dominant experience for men and women in America between 1861 and 1865. There were causes, slavery, sectional disputes, economic issues. There were consequences, fantastic consequences, emancipation, the beginning of the civil rights movement. But if you were living there, if you were alive during that time, the experience North and especially South, in the South, where one in five men of military age died, the dominant experience was you were going to die, someone you knew was going to die, somebody in your family was going to die, and you were grappling with that reality.
And I want to make sure that we don't overlook the physical reality of having to deal with, forgive the expression, thousands upon thousands of corpses laid in a field, because this was something that affected not only those who lost comrades, who lost loved ones, but just you know, residents of nearby towns sometimes, and fellow soldiers were called upon to dispose of these bodies.
You know, there's no system for burying the dead. There are a few general orders that are issued on both sides, particularly in the north, saying, listen, after a battle, circumstances permitting, mainly for health reasons, you know, it gave permission for commanding officers to find ground, purchase ground, and bury soldiers who died. But the numbers were so enormous that even those general orders were quickly overwhelmed by the size of the problem that the battles increasingly, and in increasing scale, posed to the commanding officers. So that you had at Antietam, for example, whose anniversary, 150th, we celebrate today, or observe today, you had, 22,000 casualties, 7,000 dead in 12 hours between 6 o'clock in the morning and sundown. There was no way, there were no adequate systems for tending to the wounded. The wounded were being treated by in makeshift hospital tents by having corn husks applied as bandages. This is a year and a half after the war began. And meantime, the dead, once the battle is over, litter the battlefield not for hours, but for days. There were hundreds of Confederate corpses at Antietam who were there days later when Matthew Brady's photographic team came out from New York to do a series of photographs, which absolutely stunned and in many ways transformed public awareness in the North when in November of 1862, Brady's dead at Antietam went on display on Lower Broadway in Manhattan, and suddenly people in the North, where we remember the war was mainly fought in the South. Antietam's right over the Virginia border in Maryland. The next summer there was going to be an even more epochal battle, the battle of all battles of the Civil War in Gettysburg, in south central Pennsylvania, also on northern soil. But for the most part, the war was being fought in the South. For the North, if you were a citizen of New York City, to wander into Brady's Daguerrean Gallery, you know, a few blocks south of where City Hall still stands, and see these, was to see for the first time, this is what death means. And if you were a soldier on the line, the battle's over and you've managed to survive, the work of having to deal with burying those dead bodies. I mean, there was one soldier, Oregon Bingham, from a Pennsylvania regiment, who was given the extraordinarily stressful job of burying some of the dead at Antietam. And he had to apply for and receive permission from the provost marshal's office of the Union Army to buy liquor for his men. Hmm. To dull their senses, because we don't have a kind of an understanding of what it's like to pick up corpses not by the, you know, handful or the dozens or the scores, but hundreds, indeed thousands, and try to dispose of them. And there, too, I think that Drew Faust's work in her really landmark study, this Republic of Suffering, on which our book was based. You know, here's Gettysburg. It's a byword in American history. It's kind of at the heart of the heart of the heart of the Civil War. What did Gettysburg mean? It meant a bucolic, beautiful crossroads town in south central Pennsylvania, population 2,400. After those 3 days, July 1st through 3rd, 1863, those people, citizens of Gettysburg, had casualties from, remember, these were armies, there were 150,000 men killing each other. You had scores of thousands of wounded. You had 8,000 dead. How could the population of a town of 2,400 deal with that many dead people alone? Forget about 10 times that many people who are dying. That's the kind of circumstances which are a game changer. That, as in the weeks and months after the Battle of Gettysburg, the people of Gettysburg and the Union Army, the Army of the Potomac, which held the field at the end of the day at enormous cost as Lee retreated back down south towards Virginia, ending the high watermark of the Confederacy. As the people of Gettysburg, as the military on the ground, struggled to come to terms with death on that scale, you see a seismic shift, a shift that had been aborting since Antietam, the day 150 years ago that we observe even this afternoon, where people were saying, understanding when circumstances occur where vast armies of citizens are being deployed to fight in citizen armies a war about the definition of citizenship in America, the government clearly owes to those who have fought and died something much larger than we ever saw before, ever thought we owed them before. And therefore, at Gettysburg, in the middle of the war, you have one of the very first soldiers' national cemeteries. You can't find a Revolutionary War cemetery. The government didn't bury the Revolutionary War dead. Only in the middle of the Civil War did the government understand, as Lincoln put it, and here the meaning of the Gettysburg address itself takes on new meaning, at least to me. There's the President of the United States 4 or 5 months after the battle, saying to the assembled soldiers, citizens, and dignitaries, from these honored dead, we must take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. And the dead he's talking about honoring are in unburied, stacked coffins by open graves at one of the very first national cemeteries in America. So he's saying, listen, we never thought it would come to this. We never knew that what it was to be an American would require this sacrifice. Now that we know that, we the people, we the government, owe these men something more than we ever thought before we owed them.
Filmmaker Rick Burns is my guest. His new documentary, Death and the Civil War, premieres tomorrow night on PBS's American Experience. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can send email to join us at think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Rick Burns. His new documentary, Death and the Civil War, premieres tomorrow night on PBS's American Experience. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Rick, talk about this, the promises that Abraham Lincoln made at Gettysburg about honoring our war dead were initially only really kept for or extended to Union soldiers.
You know, when you have a civil war, the genie that gets let out of the bottle, it's the genie that gets let out of the bottle in all warfare, is happening inside the body politic of a nation. And one of the terrible, grim paradoxes of having lived through and fought a civil war is how, when that war is over, certainly when it's still going, as it was when the Gettysburg Cemetery was opened in the fall of 1863, how is it that you come to some reconciled view of the nature of the valor on both sides? Obviously, men fought nobly and with extraordinary courage and an enormous suffering and sacrifice on both sides. But some of those men were fighting, self-evidently, to preserve the Union. Others were fighting for all sorts of reasons that ultimately meant the Union would be divided. And whatever the reasons, whatever the abstract rationales, the very concrete reality of it is people are killing and dying in the most hideous circumstances. Human beings do not enter the existential sphere of that reality, killing and dying, and they can never be expected to be unchanged. You cannot ask men. You cannot ask citizens of a country who have fought over 4 years to feel the same way about their antagonists, even if those antagonists are already and have always been, quote, Americans. And at the end of the war, when the reburial movement began, and we have to understand, after Appomattox, it wasn't as if the war was over. The military action had ceased, but the South, across a 1,000-mile frontier, a theater of war that stretched from, you know, Richmond all the way to Vicksburg and into the Missouri and beyond, was a boneyard. There were hundreds of thousands of unburied, scarcely buried Americans, Americans buried in mass graves, Americans who were dead because other Americans had killed them. How it was that you could ask each side to forget that they had waged that kind of warfare and suddenly imagine that they were all citizens of the same country. So as the reburial movement gathered steam in 1865, 1866, the question came up, shouldn't we, the United States, bury the Southern dead? And I think inevitably the answer was, we cannot say that those who had fought and died to destroy the Union should be honored in the same way as those who had fought and died to save it. Now, we may wish, I may wish, as I do, 150 years later, that it had worked out differently. Because the fact that the equivalent of $75 million in 21st century dollars was spent to bury the Union dead only had a tremendously scarring impact. The South, having lost everything in the war, now was forced to consider that their dead were not being treated as deserving the same respect as those who had fought and died in the North for a cause that was ultimately victorious. That stark, I mean, it's a perpendicular divide that in some sense is irreconcilable. So much of the posterity of America after the Civil War, so much of the sense we live in a country in which some sections of it feel suspicious and angry towards government. Others feel that government is one of the agencies we can look to with the most trust. That sharp disparity really began in the Civil War over what I think was probably an inevitable state of affairs. The North could not bury the Southern dead, and therefore left to the South the burying of the dead to private agencies and, remarkably, to women's groups, ladies' memorial associations from Richmond to Chattanooga to Memphis to New Orleans and beyond, whose job it was to raise money through bake sales, through private means, not through congressional appropriation, to bury the Southern dead. And therefore, what you had left lingering, and we're not talking about weeks or months, we're talking about years and decades, generations after the Civil War, a feeling that those who had fought and died for the Confederacy never had that ability to understand that their cause, that they had died in a cause that was finally justifiable, that finally had been put to some plausible, practicable end. And so the myth of the lost cause is what came kind of floating out of those unburied dead Confederate graves. Confederates in life, Confederates let them be in death, as one South Carolina churchman put it. And I think that we live with that consequence for a very long time. And I think in a fundamental way, it's not a Northern or a Southern fault. It's that when warfare occurs, we've known this since well before the ancient Greeks, well before Homer and the Iliad, that it is a cycle of violence which takes a very, very long time to recover from. I think we're still recovering from it, and maybe the meaning of this sesquicentennial observance is, and of Drew Faust's remarkable book about death in the Civil War, is that we're confronting the irreducible existential reality of it in a way that perhaps we haven't been able to for 150 years, and saying this is what it meant. It meant the ultimate for people, North and South. 1 in 10 men of military age in the North, 1 in 5 in the South. These astronomical numbers, which are numbers that we're not going to see again until the 20th century, the century we associate with modern mass warfare. Well, for once, America was way ahead of its European, you know, forebears in having pioneered the way to mass death, and also perhaps in having pioneered the way to what a society does when it does that to itself. And I can really feel it here in the beginning of the 21st century. We're just, in a way, all traumas this great take a very long time to metabolize. And I think that in a very profound way, with respect to this existential, irreducible aspect of the war, we may be coming closer now than we've ever come since that generation that fought and died and suffered.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Lee in Fort Worth. Hi, Lee.
Hi, how are you guys?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question regarding the commanders. Now, he made a good case about those that were sent out to bury the dead and the psychological effect on them, but what about the men that ordered them into battle only to see their formations destroyed?
Right.
What about that, Rick? How much is recorded about the psychological implications for commanders?
You know, I think what you had during the first part of the war, during 61, 62, and even into 63, which was a command, a high command on both sides, which were desperate to try to fight a war, a modern war, really according to 18th century values. And that would be a war in which you wouldn't have casualties of anything like this number, and in which a knockout blow would be administered and the other side would walk away. Remember, when the war began, both sides were convinced the other side wouldn't fight. Why would the North fight to keep the South? Why wouldn't they just say, erring sisters, go? You know, the South was convinced of its own martial military superiority in cultural respects. The North was similarly certain. They had such a preponderance of means and men and materiel, surely the South would understand that it was inevitable that they would lose and put down their arms. But that didn't happen. And the people in high command, whether it was Lincoln or McClellan, you know, in the North, or Davis and soon Robert E. Lee in the South, hoped against hope that they would deliver an 18th century, early 19th century knockout blow, that it would become apparent to Europe that the Confederacy needed to be recognized. Something would happen, a kind of a deus ex machina would happen, and the bloodshed would stop. What finally happened was you had leaders, particularly leaders in the North, who understood, as Lincoln put it, that the arithmetic of the war had to be grasped. And that arithmetic is a very difficult concept to get one's mind around, then or now. It means an understanding this was going to be a war of attrition, not a war of a knockout blow. It was going to be a war that was going to go on and on, as George Will puts it in our film. It would be a war of societies and massed armies fighting each other, in which one side, the North, would have vast superiority, but in which that superiority would be implemented slowly, incrementally, and in a phrase that haunts me still from George Will, a superiority lubricated every step of the way with blood. And, you know, we very quickly find ourselves in the domain of the same kind of question that comes up with respect to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Was it right to administer violence on that level, or was it wrong? And in some sense, that's the question that we first began to ask as a nation during our own Civil War. Was it right, as Lincoln knew and felt certain it was, to insist that he had to find a general, as he put it, who could face the arithmetic? What that means is a general who would not flinch, as George McClellan did, from bloodshed on that scale, but instead pursue the opportunities, pursue the victories, in fact, gather himself even in defeat and throw his forces back in, because the sooner you ended it, the better. And that only when you had a general who grasped that it was going to be a meat-grinding, horrific war of attrition with casualties exponentially greater than Americans or indeed people in any war before had imagined possible, that it was going to be brought to an end. You know, my own personal view is that, and I think it's shared by many, you know, historians who know far better than I, that, you know, when Grant was put in charge of the Union armies after his victories at Vicksburg and Chattanooga in 63, finally a more sophisticated understanding, a more concrete and accurate understanding of what the war was at hand. And then look what happened. One of the most striking and horrific realities of the Civil War is that when Abraham Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address in the fall of 1863, after 2.5 years of war, not yet half of the dead had been created. In 1864 and early 65, fully 50% of the Civil War dead were made dead. I mean, this is horrific reality, and yet, in some sense, it is probably true that if the war had lingered on with officers who, for the best humanitarian reasons, shrank from the levels of violence and death, it could have gone on even longer. Hmm. So you find yourselves, you know, Drew Faust is quoted very aptly, the historian Paul Fussell, who says, all wars are ironic, because all wars begin processes that are very different than what the people who start them think they're going to be. And it is like a genie being let out of a bottle, and you can't know where it's going. And as difficult as it is to uncork that genie, it is 1,000 times more difficult to get the genie back in the bottle. And this is just one of myriad ways in which this war, which may seem ancient and antique to some people 150 years ago, Antietam, is so relevant to our world today. You know, war at some level is war. And we, in what I think is the lesson of all lessons for me from Drew Faust's remarkable book, it's not an anti-war book. It's not a book that's saying, look what we do when we kill each other in warfare. It's a book that's saying, if we must understand what war is to know under what circumstances it's worth fighting it. We must understand those who die, the circumstances under which they die, the impact that has not just on them and their comrades, but their family, their community, and their entire nation. That only when we grasp what war is in that sort of what the gyres of widening impact that it of suffering that it brings, can we understand these are the circumstances under which, yes, we want to bring war. That's not an anti-war or pro-war stance. It's a stance that simply says we have to have the right information on the ground. And I find it very moving that Drew, 140 years later, really saw it as her mission to say, what was it like to be there?
Rick Burns' new documentary is called Death and the Civil War. It premieres tomorrow night on PBS stations, including KERA Channel 13 in North Texas, as part of the American Experience series. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, I'm so honored to be on your show.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.